The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the show. We've got a fascinating look at a bunch of different topics today, but we're going to spend our first half hour talking about one of the more fascinating things going on in the world of money today, and that's the issue of bitcoins. They seem to be capturing the imagination of everyone, given all the recent press attention to them. And we're going to talk a little bit about what they are and what their legality is and what it means for all of us going forward. Pretty cool topic since we're a digital radio show to be talking about digital currency. Joining us, Carol Van Cleef, a partner at Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office, where she focuses her practice on a variety of regulatory and compliance enforcement matters, things like anti-money laundering, electronic payments, and other bank regulatory issues. So somebody who's very well-versed to talk about this. Carol, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Let's start at the beginning. So I've seen this stuff about Bitcoin, but tell me exactly what is it and how would I get my hands on one if I wanted to?
Well, Kevin, first I'd like to say thank you for inviting me today, and it is very timely given a number of press developments this week. Bitcoins is in a category where that of what we call digital or cryptocurrencies. It is a currency that you actually mine on your own computer. If we go back to the days when you used to go to a gold, find a place you could go mine gold, well, now you can sit in front of your computer and through a fairly complex algorithm with a number of steps, you yourself can actually mine a Bitcoin. If you don't have the time, which a lot of people don't have enough time to really sit and go through the process, you can go and buy Bitcoins from other people. What is a Bitcoin? It's something that is, as I said, you mine it on your computer, you store it on your computer, it represents, it is a coin, and actually there are physical or pictorial representations of the Bitcoin. It is really a system of a sequence of numbers that identify the fact that you hold something with a particular value, and that value is whatever the market will attach to it. And we can talk about that a little bit more as well.
So you told me a little bit about Bitcoin. It seems like Amazon is trying to get into this space too. I got an email this week saying, gosh, you made so many purchases. Here are some Amazon coins. Are they the same thing, or are they substantially different than Bitcoin?
They're very different. In the case of Bitcoin, there's no one central place or person that's issuing the Bitcoin. Again, I said it was you can mine it on your own computer using an algorithm. In the case of Amazon has decided that it wants to put out something that represents value, and it becomes, quote, the issuer of the Amazon coin or Amazon dollar. There are other types of digital or digitized currencies. Many of us are familiar. If you are into gaming, you're familiar with, say, some of the more popular games that have their own currencies that you can use in that game, maybe to buy players, maybe to buy a better spot in the game, but it's something that used within the game. Amazon's going a little bit further, and they're creating a value exchange system that can be used with different Amazon merchants to purchase goods or services. There's another form of a digital currency out there, or has been in the past, called e-gold, which is in a category of what we would say privately issued currencies that are backed or reserved by a commodity, in this case gold, and are provided to people in a digital form. I know it gets pretty complicated, but these are important distinctions, because when you start to look at and evaluate the value of what you own and how you can use it, these distinctions become very important.
I see. Interesting. So, again, I can kind of mine this coin, which is fascinating, but I'm not sure I have the attention span or the computing power to sit around and mint money, although I'm fascinated by the concept. So if I don't, I know reading, one of the things that really fascinated me about this, Carol, was reading that the Winklevoss twins, the guys who were involved in the big Facebook dispute from Harvard with Mark Zuckerberg, were trying to corner the market on bitcoins, which I really didn't understand. So obviously there's some sort of marketplace. What are they doing? How do you get your money on this stuff, your hands on this money?
Okay, so let's start with the easy example, is that I do have the time and patience, and I decide that I'm going to mine some bitcoins. After going through maybe taking a few days or longer, I finally get my first Bitcoin, and I'm very proud of that. And now I say, okay, so what is this worth? You come up and say, hey, I want a Bitcoin. And I ask you, how much are you willing to pay me for it? And let's say you say, I'll give you a dollar for it. Or maybe you'll say, I'll give you 10, or I'll even give you $100 for that Bitcoin. We make a deal, you give me $100, and I will transfer my Bitcoin from my Bitcoin wallet to your Bitcoin wallet. And now you have your own Bitcoin. You have decided you want to pay me for that. So take the twins and their desire. They have some excess capital, maybe because of a company or two that they've been involved in the potential creation of. And they've got extra money, and they decide they want to go out and buy bitcoins from a lot of people who've been mining them. And once they acquire those bitcoins, then they decide that they're going to turn around and sell them to other people for maybe a higher rate if people are willing to pay for it.
So they
become what we call a Bitcoin exchanger.
Okay. All right. So there are these exchanges. So I have to ask, this makes me sound like, you know, grumpy old grandparent or something, but why does something where you've worked an algorithm on your computer to develop this Bitcoin virtual currency, why does that have any actual value? And what's the marketplace? I know there's been some fluctuations, right? Because apparently people like the Winklevoss is getting in. You're getting the sort of speculation that makes me think about Dutch tulip crazes of the past.
Well, I'll go one further. When the financial crisis was fully erupting in Cyprus, the price of the bitcoins went up, the exchange value went up significantly, doubled in a period of about a week and a half or 2 weeks. The speculation was running quite high that people were exiting the Cyprus banks and trying to find a, quote, safe haven for their funds and moving them into bitcoins. There has been a lot of research that's been done by the U.S. government, in particular our law enforcement agencies, looking at what the uses of bitcoins have been. What they have reported on in a couple of well-publicized reports, that bitcoins are being used heavily by criminals for drug trades, especially online drug trades, but by other types of criminal elements that are interested in moving funds, moving value around the world very quickly. And why is it attractive? Because of the level of anonymity that bitcoins offer the holder. While Bitcoins, you can see how many Bitcoins, you can go to a website and you can track and see how many Bitcoins have been mined. You can even see the transactions and the dollar values related to the transfer of Bitcoins from one person to another. But you cannot identify the person who is undertaking that transaction. It really takes us back to the days of cash that, you know, if I give you a dollar bill, no one knows that I'm giving that dollar bill to you. How you decide to use it depends on whether, you know, your use of that's going to be tracked by any regulatory governmental agency.
Well, Carol, so that's a very interesting point, though. When you and I trade dollar bills, you know, in exchange for that Coke in your hands, the government doesn't necessarily know about it, but it seems to me like everything digital I do leaves a footprint. So how is it that us trading Bitcoins over the Internet isn't eventually going to end up on somebody's radar screen?
Well, one of the biggest issues that our law enforcement community has had is the fact that our laws have not kept a pace of the technological developments. The U.S. has spent the last 40-plus years trying to put into place a system that would provide a full record-keeping and reporting methodology to track the use of funds through our banking and broader financial system under our Bank Secrecy Act. Just as that whole framework has really become effective to assuring a greater level of ability to trace the movement of funds, suddenly we have disruptors like the digital and cryptocurrencies come into play, which upset the apple cart. And as I said, we just don't have the legal system fully in place yet. Now, in the last month or so, our Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, better known as FinCEN, came out with a ruling that deemed the currency exchangers, and to the extent that there may be what we call administrators of these digital or cryptocurrencies, if they exist, that they now fall under the jurisdiction of our Bank Secrecy Act, and they have to comply in the same kinds of ways with the rules on reporting cash transactions over $10,000 or reporting suspicious activity related to the use of the financials, that particular financial service company, to the U.S. government. We're still in very early stages, and I think there are still a number of the Bitcoin companies out there that are operating that are sort of scratching their heads and saying, you know, they've said this, but it really doesn't totally fit us yet. So we've got some challenges from a public policy standpoint.
Yeah, well, I want to talk some more about those challenges. You know, when we're going to take a break here in a minute, come back. But I really want to figure out, you know, there are people like me who are married and we have, we share a checking account, but my wife runs some things through eBay and occasion, you know, uses that for mad money. And my question is, am I going to discover she's mining Bitcoins to, have her own stash of cash on the side? I'm interested in exploring that. But let's take a break. We'll come back in a minute. We'll talk more with Carol Van Cleef about Bitcoins and the future of digital currency right here on Capital Thinking.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everyone. We're talking about the future of digital currency. Our guest is Carol Van Cleef, an expert in a variety of banking regulatory issues and a partner at the Washington offices of Patton Boggs. Carol, when we left it in our last segment, you were talking about how criminal elements and some people perhaps of dubious backgrounds were beginning to use digital currency like bitcoins to move money around with in an anonymous fashion. I brought up to you my wife, who would like to have some money outside of our joint account, occasionally sells a couple of things on eBay and uses it to feed her Lily Pulitzer and Lululemon habits that I'm not supposed to know about. And so I guess my question is, are normal people like her using bitcoins, or is it really just hasn't evolved yet to everyday use by folks who want to just use it for convenience purposes?
Kevin, great question. I do a lot of work with all sorts of emerging payments business models. What we find time and time again, whether it's the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or in mobile payments or otherwise, the first adopters typically are the criminal elements because they're testing to see how they can use it to accomplish their goals, which is the movement of money with as much or value with anonymity as fast as possible. I think what's happening with Bitcoin, what we have seen over the last several months, is that it is gaining more and more mainstream recognition, and with recognition adoption, so that we find more and more merchants signing up to accept Bitcoin Bitcoins as payment. Likewise, we are finding more and more individuals that are looking at Bitcoins as a possible way to make their transactions. I found very interesting a recent conversation with a top regulator, state regulator, who is very familiar from the side of the world he lives in with emerging payments. And he said he's had interesting conversations with his son, who happens to be a middle school teacher, and finding that the middle school kids are totally into Bitcoins, whether they think they're getting something for nothing or almost nothing because they can go mine Bitcoins themselves, or because possibly they're using a technology that their parents don't quite get yet. This is where we are moving from into a much more mainstream adoption arena for Bitcoins now. And I think that may be driven in part by the articles that we've been seeing in the papers and the news feeds, and likewise, yeah, those are driving the acceptance.
So let's talk about one of those press developments. You've got the Department of Homeland Security earlier this week seizing the assets of a Bitcoin exchanger. Tell us a little bit about Obviously, it's been a bad week for the Department of Justice to do things that people say have sort of exceeded the scope of the law. So what's their legal theory that this is something they can do?
This is an issue they've been working on for quite a while, and I say quite a while, going back at least 2 to 3 years and maybe longer. They have seen in criminal investigations the use of bitcoins to move value. That has led to the reports that I mentioned earlier about how criminals are using bitcoins. They have then worked to put some pieces of the legal picture into place to make it a little bit easier for them to pursue action against this type of a business model. That includes the action I mentioned by FinCEN about a little over a month ago, where it came out and said those who are involved in digital virtual currencies like this, if they're selling, exchanging, or administrating, they are subject to these laws. And if you don't register with FinCEN the way you're supposed to register as a money service business, I know we're getting to a lot of technicalities here, but that becomes the basis for a federal criminal action, which then can be a predicate offense for a money laundering criminal violation, which in turn triggers the ability of the Department of Justice to seize the assets of whomever is involved in the transaction. So it's a very significant step, and but I will say there is also precedent for this. If we go back 5 and 6 years ago, this I mentioned earlier, eGold. eGold was a situation where the again, technology that was way out in front of the legal system. There was concern at the time about how it was being used, and really the roadmap for the action that was taken this week came out of the eGold case.
Interesting. So what does that mean? We talked a little bit earlier about the volatility of this market. What does something like this do to the volatility of the prices and the security of people who are exchangers?
Again, it's a great question. We've been monitoring this very closely. The action was taken, the seizure of assets related to the largest Bitcoin exchanger was taken on Tuesday afternoon. The price over the last 5 days of a Bitcoin has traded, the price has been between $112 and $116 per Bitcoin. We have not seen a great deal of fluctuation. I mean, some marketplaces, maybe 4% would be a great fluctuation, but when you consider after the Cyprus event, the price of a Bitcoin was well over $200. We just haven't seen that kind of volatility. What it's likely to do in the short term is probably move a lot of the exchange activity offshore outside of the United States, which will then probably further complicate the efforts of the U.S. government to try to bring some orderly regulation to the marketplace.
Interesting. You mentioned, Carol, earlier this other digital currency from a few years back, eGold, and maybe that's what the Nigerian prince who keeps emailing me was promising me was eGold, because his payments have never come in, even though I sent him my Social Security number. But tell us, are there lessons you can learn from that eGold state a few years ago, that case that maybe apply to the future of things like Bitcoin?
I think there's some very important lessons for those who are Bitcoin exchangers in particular. In the case of eGold, eGold was actually acting rather responsibly and taking a number of actions, recognizing that there were abuses occurring in its system. And quite frankly, there are abuses that occur in any financial institution. It's really how the financial institution reacts to it. And we see that again and again through the banking system. Quite honestly, there are questions about the legal advice that they received at the time, making sure that an exchanger has a lawyer who has an appropriate understanding of the legal issues surrounding this space is extraordinarily important. Making decisions of reading the statute yourself and saying, well, let's see, it says currency, and currency means sovereign currency, so therefore these statutes don't apply to me. That's not the right approach to take. In the Eagle case, lots of money was spent. Ultimately, there was a plea agreement that was entered into. At sentencing, the judge acknowledged the fact that this system wasn't a bad system, that it just happened to be adopted by people, bad people, very early on. And in fact said that she did not feel that the principals, the founder of Eagle, was a criminal. But the bottom line is after this plea agreement, that system can't go on. And the Bitcoin exchangers who are out there need to really understand that they run the risk of having their legal livelihood cut off if they don't take the appropriate steps. Then there's the question about the customer. What happens to the customer? As long as there's demand for Bitcoins, the price will be what the market dictates it will be. At some point, though, it's very possible that the price could go to zero. And the question is, what happens to people who are holding what may have been last week or a month ago, $500,000 worth of Bitcoins? What will happen if the market disappears? The Eagle case is very interesting because in that case, there's gold backing, the currency. And when the system shut down because of the legal difficulties, the gold was there to be sold, and the value returned to the account holders. And in fact, the account holders in that case benefited from a rapidly rising gold price. So when the system was shut down, gold is about $990. When they're getting their payouts, they're going to be paid out around $1,500 to $1,600 per unit of measure that they had. In this case, if the Bitcoin market were to crash, and I'm not saying it's going to, but if it were to crash, there would not be any store of value, any reserve to back up the value of the Bitcoin.
Interesting. Carol, got about 2 minutes left. Do you think there anything else? You mentioned offshore, and I guess I'm wondering, is there some competitive advantage to the United States in taking the lead in regulating this type of industry from the get-go?
The United States has felt for a while that when it comes to internet-based money service business models like this, or money transfer systems or value transfer systems, that without the cooperation of other governments, it's a very difficult area to regulate effectively. There are other countries that are addressing issues related to bitcoins. We've seen action in particular from UK and from one other country to date. With a model like this, again, any internet model, you push the button and you are live in 195 or 200 or whatever the appropriate number of countries almost instantly. Many of the countries are putting more and more regulation in and around these areas. Bitcoin, though, is a very difficult one to regulate, unlike the Eagle system where there was a clear single administrator running the Eagle system. There is no single administrator, so that you could close it down in one country, but it can pop up and be an effective market in another country. One of the issues, though, for the Bitcoin exchangers is that even if you're operating outside the United States, if you are reaching and touching U.S. residents, they do technically become subject to U.S. jurisdiction. And in fact, this case this week was seizing assets that were owed to the Bitcoin exchanger that was based in Japan. So there wasn't, that Bitcoin exchanger wasn't even in the United States, but was touching U.S. residents, which is how we asserted jurisdiction. It's going to be critical for the Bitcoin exchangers and for the Bitcoin marketplace as a whole to organize appropriately and look to start to affect positively the legal and regulatory systems in various countries to eliminate some of the uncertainty that we're seeing that's at play right now.
Interesting. Carol, hit everyone with your contact information if they want more info from you.
It's carol.vancleef at, or I'm sorry, it's cvancleef at pattenboggs.com.
All right, terrific. We've been joined by Carol Van Cleef. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about some recent decisions at the FCC.
Thank you.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, if you're like me, nothing annoys you more than when you're home for dinner or you're sitting down watching the ball game, the phone rings, and it's a telemarketer trying to give you something you don't want and who often won't take no fast enough for an answer. Joining us to talk about some issues regarding telemarketers, Paul Bezosi, a TechCom partner at the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, someone who regularly appears here on Capital Thinking. He comes back today to talk about a new Federal Communications Commission declaratory ruling that impacts third-party marketers. So, Paul, welcome back to the show. Tell us a little bit about this decision.
Well, this decision arises under the FCC's responsibility for implementing the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. That's a statute that Congress passed back in 1991 that regulates the use of telemarketing, the marketing of goods or services by telephone. Congress acted back at that time because consumers were outraged at the hundreds of thousands of calls they were getting from telemarketers. So the statute restricts the use in particular of artificial and pre-recorded voice messages, we call them robocalls, to residential phone lines. And it also sets up a possibility of a do not call list that probably many consumers have joined already, that if you put your number on that list, you're not supposed to get telemarketing calls. And the law includes a private right of action for consumers to bring court actions against violators of these provisions. So these calls are still a fairly significant problem. If you look at the most recent statistics issued by the FCC for the last quarter of 2012, There are over 35,000 complaints with the FCC under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, including 19,000 by consumers complaining that even though their name was on this do not call list, they still received calls. So it continues to be an issue. There continues to be a fair amount of court litigation, class action lawsuits, and incrementally the scope of responsibility is being expanded, and that's what the FCC did, in fact, last week.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. So the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, talk to us a little bit about those do not call requirements and why you mentioned these pretty staggering numbers. Why are we still having these major problems?
Well, I think the problems continue because telemarketers are less than rigorous about identifying numbers that are on that list, getting the data, scrubbing the call lists that they have and they use to make these telemarketing calls. And as a result, people continue to receive them. And these legal actions brought under the Act and under the FTC's telemarketing sales rule are, becoming a principal mechanism for trying to police that failure to pay attention to detail.
Ah, very interesting. Well, tell us exactly what the FCC decision does and doesn't do this week.
Well, this decision is the outgrowth of complaints about telemarketing calls made by independent third-party telemarketers who've been contracted for by a provider of satellite TV services. And these telemarketers allegedly made calls violating the Telephone Consumer Protection Act provisions I mentioned above relating to the do not call list and pre-recorded messages. And the courts asked the FCC, the expert agency, about whether and under what circumstances the provider of the satellite services could be held liable for the contractor's violations. And the FCC said basically, even though the sellers, the provider of the services, had no role in actually placing the offending calls, they could be held liable under the principle that those contractors were acting as agents of the seller. And they actually articulated a fairly expansive concept of agency to include apparent authority of the telemarketer. So if the consumer had a reasonable belief the telemarketer was authorized by the service provider to make the call, that would be a factor in determining that the seller was potentially liable under the TCPA. Similarly, they applied the principle of ratification, where the seller knowingly accepts the benefits of the telemarketer's activities. So here you have a situation where the seller of the product or service can be vicariously held liable for the acts of a third party it's not directly supervising, it's not directly controlling.
Interesting. Well, so who should be worried about this decision and why?
Well, I think, Kevin, any company that uses third-party telemarketers to market their products or services has to be concerned and has to take a close look at the scope of the commission's decision and certain guidance that they provided therein. I mean, it clearly opens up the prospect that those sellers could be held vicariously liable for violations of the telemarketers. And the TCPA allows recovery of either actual dollar loss or up to $500 per violation, whichever is greater. So there's the potential for a fairly significant economic exposure here if the sellers don't take some steps to ensure that they are protected, that they are insulated from vicarious liability.
Gotcha. So anything you think those potentially affected companies can be doing to avoid just that situation?
Well, I think they have to take a close look at the arrangements that they have with the third-party telemarketers that they may be using. and they should be considering how they can, consistent with some of the guidance provided by the FCC decision, mitigate the prospect that they could be held liable. And in fact, I think they should be doing kind of an audit of how they use and manage the telemarketing arrangements that they have in place. To what extent are they monitoring the activity? To what extent are they getting information about who is being called, the types of calls that are being made? To what extent do their contracts with these entities have indemnification or other provisions that might protect them from vicarious liability? To what extent do the telemarketers have certain access to information that the sellers maintain on customers and potential customers? These are some of the things that the commission talked about in its decision as indications that the telemarketers had apparent authority, that ratification was going on, that clearly there was an agency relationship in existence. So I would say that any company that is using these kinds of entities to help market its services, products or services, needs to take a close look at these, because there has been a lot of litigation activity. These cases itself arose out of lawsuits that were brought, one by a consumer, one by actually the United States on behalf of the FTC, going after these violations. And this opens up the prospect that there could be more of that type of legal activity, and sellers could face more of that litigation unless they take steps to protect themselves.
Gotcha. So we've talked about the FCC. Are there other federal agencies that are involved in this now or maybe in the future?
Well, the Federal Trade Commission has a rule called the telemarketing sales rule that has a do not call feature, and it has been quite aggressive as well in policing telemarketing calls and robocalls to consumers who don't want to receive them. In fact, in the last few days, they've entered into a consent decree with an entity that was enabling these types of calls by providing a kind of a voice broadcasting platform that third parties could use to communicate and telemarket with customers. And they went after that entity and wound up entering into a consent decree, and which included a financial penalty and some fairly extensive requirements for the owner of the platform or the provider of the platform to police what its customers were using the platform for. So the Federal Trade Commission, along with the FCC, it continues to be, and I think will continue to be, very active in the area of policing robocalls, and these developments could open up a broader assault by consumers and class action attorneys to bring these actions to enforce the broader requirements.
Very good. Well, Paul, hit everyone with your contact information if they want to find out more.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm at pbezozzi, P-B-E-S-O-Z-Z-I, at patentbogs.com, 202-457-5292.
Very good. All right, we'll be back with our last segment in just a minute. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
6,000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We are joined by George Schutzer, a partner in Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office, who helps business and nonprofit clients on tax matters. He focuses on financing transactions, tax-exempt organizations, partnerships, limited liability companies. And today our topic is tax consequences for non-compensatory partner options. George, that sounds an awful lot like me finding out there are tax consequences for my partner at home telling me I have to take the trash out on Tuesday. I suspect you're talking about something different, some new regulations the IRS put out earlier this year in Treasury. So talk to us a little bit about the details of those regulations.
The regulations have been hanging around for about 10 years in proposed form. The IRS finalized them in February. They address the tax consequences of non-compensatory options and convertible issue instruments issued by partnerships. So a partnership can, in addition to issuing partnership interests, provide somebody with an option to acquire a partnership interest at a later date. Partnerships can do this in two contexts. One, as reimbursement for services, in which case they're compensatory options. We're still waiting for regulations on those. And in other cases, the options are in effect paid for by a third party, and those are viewed as non-compensatory options.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And then what the new regulations do is spell out some of the tax consequences of the non-compensatory options.
All right. So how do they use a test to figure out, these options and what do the results mean?
Most of what we see in the regulations is pretty much what I think tax practitioners expected, that the issuance of an option is not a taxable event, that the exercise of an option is generally not a taxable event, though it can have tax consequences in terms of affecting subsequent allocations. I think the big area of concern to a variety of taxpayers who are involved in this area relates to whether an option is in fact considered an option for tax purposes or whether the option is considered a partnership interest for tax purposes. And what we see is a number of investment funds that have tax-exempt members or foreign members, and those funds are seeking not to have unrelated business taxable income and not to have what's known as effectively connected income from a U.S. trade or business. If they're treated as partners in partnerships in which they invest, they will end up with that sort of income. So often, as part of a transaction in which they're making a loan to a business conducted in the form of a partnership or limited liability company, they, in addition to making the loan, receive an option or a warrant to acquire an interest in the underlying entity, with the expectation that the warrant or option will be exercised only when the company is sold, so that the holder never really becomes a partner. But the concern is that in some cases the regulations will cause the fund to become a partner.
Interesting. Okay, so talk to me. Obviously, it doesn't sound like my trip to the trash can on Tuesday is covered by these regulations. So who is covered, George?
Where we, most of the non-compensatory options that we see are options that are acquired in connection with the making of a loan. So a mid-sized business goes to a mezzanine lender. The mezzanine lender offers to loan X dollars to the company, but also says, if we're going to make the loan, we also want to acquire some upside. If your business is successful, we'd like an option or a warrant to acquire interest in your company. For tax purposes, the amount that's loaned actually gets divided between the loan and the fair market value, the warrant that sometimes creates what's called original issue discount on the loan and gives the company a basis in the warrant. But the company is paying for the warrant, so it's viewed as a non-compensatory option or warrant. In some cases, you may have partnerships just selling options or warrants the way corporations sometimes do. But the most frequent place in which we see non-compensatory options, and for that matter, convertible instruments, are that are non-compensatory are coming from lenders.
Interesting. So if I don't comply, what are the consequences for me for failure to treat these non-compensatory options as a partner?
The IRS can come in, look at the partnership, say that the option holder was a partner for tax purposes. Therefore, a portion of the income of the partnership needs to be allocated to the partner. In most cases, that just means additional tax liability for the partner. But if the partner happens to be a tax-exempt organization or a foreign company, or more importantly or more realistically, the partner is a fund and the fund includes a tax-exempt entity or a foreign entity, there can be adverse consequences. In the case of a nonprofit organization, the nonprofit organization will end up with unrelated business taxable income and have to pay tax. That's not necessarily all that bad, and a small amount of unrelated business taxable income is not going to jeopardize the tax-exempt status of the tax-exempt entity. It's a bigger problem for foreign entities that are trying to avoid having effectively connected income in the United States, and therefore trying to avoid having to file U.S. tax returns and being subject to audit by the IRS. So that's the real area of concern, and that is the area where I think we're going to find some funds that were previously taking options directly, thinking that they may need to establish a blocker corporation to hold the option, to make sure that they don't cause their foreign investors to inadvertently be considered engaged in U.S. trade or business.
George, you mentioned this stuff's been hanging around for quite a while. Are there other things related to this that you see in the pipeline?
We're certainly expecting to see regulations on compensatory options. Those are the ones that are provided to employees of the partnership, as well as perhaps going a little bit beyond the compensatory option, but compensatory interests that are provided for services. There are some old rulings that folks rely on now regarding what's a profits interest to make sure that when you give an interest to a service provider, that that does not create a taxable event. And when those regulations come out, they'll provide us with further guidance on what needs to be done to avoid creating a tax liability when an interest is issued or a right to acquire an interest is issued to a service provider, to a partnership.
Very good. George, you want to hit everyone with your contact information if they want to learn more about this subject?
It's gschutzer at patentbogs.com, gschutzer at patentbogs.com.
Great. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Capital Thinking. We hope everyone has a terrific weekend. We'll see you more next week here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.